Okay, now we're to our afternoon agenda. Again, thank you all for waiting for that. For those who came for this, item 1054, please.
Establish a tax on the demolition of certain residential structures in the city of Portland.
Well, this is an issue that we've all heard a lot about, and let me set the stage for this discussion this afternoon. There's not a lot of precedent for what we're talking about here. As far as I know from my staff's research, there's one other city in the United States that has used tax policy as a way to try to control the rate of demolition. We, of course, use the zoning code, and earlier this year we made some changes to our demolition code to improve how much notice is given and the opportunity for a neighborhood to negotiate in a situation where a house is proposed to be demolished. I'm glad we made those changes, but I think all of us knew even then that that wasn't going to be sufficient to the really addressing the problem in a meaningful way. It is damage control, and maybe to an extent so is this. The proposal here is to apply a tax to the demolition of single-family homes and then to use those funds for the support of affordable home ownership programs in the city. I want to tell you, as the person who put this idea on the table for discussion here today, that I'm not sure that we have calibrated this right to get the effect that we want. That is, some people will probably testify today that this is way too high. Others will testify that it's way too low. And we still have fine points to consider about exactly what situations it does and doesn't apply to, what constitutes demolition, and what constitutes a derelict house, all of which relate to how this will work in practice. My hope is that the effect of this tax will be, if it's adopted by the council in some form after today's hearing and more discussion and further refinement, my hope is that this will cut the rate of demolition of serviceable houses in half and produce a couple million dollars a year for affordable housing for our fellow citizens who'd like to be able to buy one. That's the goal, at least my goal, and it's open to discussion because this is an innovation about whether this particular tool is a good idea at all, whether we've got it right in its current draft, or whether some different approach would get to that result. I hope most of us share the goal that we want to see good old houses kept if they're serviceable and remodelable, and we want to see houses that are a blight on the neighborhood, boarded up, occupied by squatters, otherwise toxic, torn down as quickly as possible and replaced by a habitable home. So that's the goal. I want to call up Jillian Detweiler and some other staff to walk us through the proposal, and then we'll take testimony. So, Jillian,
at what point do you want to entertain amendments?
Probably right after Jillian and Thomas walk through the proposal. Thomas is here, anyway. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'll let you get us started then.
Thomas Lanham, the Director of the Revenue Division of the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services.
Andy Peterson, Bureau of Development Services, Plan Review and Permitting Manager. So with the duo of the trio here, we'll start off a little bit.
Your microphone's not working, so okay. Let's get Carla to fix that, please.
How's that?
There
works?
We go.
Okay.
Now you're on.
All right. So the establishment of a tax on demolition, we'll click through the process here. Just as an overview, the information regarding this proposal, we'll talk about the tax structure, proposed tax structure, including exemptions and rebates that are being proposed, as well as some of the definitions that have been adopted by council, both on demolition, major remodels, alterations, and additions, as well as some Title 29 residential structures that have an order to be vacated or demolished from the city code hearings officer. What I'm showing here are a couple examples of houses that have been demolished on the left-hand side and the replacement structures on the right, which would include two new houses on a site that previously contained one. These are in R5. This is in an R5 zone, residential 5,000 square foot lot minimum. This, again, is a single house on the left-hand side that was demolished with a replacement house on the right. The lot size here is 4,000 square feet, and the structure built there is conforming to the R5 zoning code requirements. Again, house on the left-hand side demolished with a house and a accessory structure on the drive, and the replacement house on the shown on the right-hand side. There's a variety of structures and development occurring based on the demolition and replacement that's happening here. Jillian, if there's items you want to add to these as we go through, feel free.
Thanks. I was not here when you started. Jillian Detweiler, Mayor's Office, Mayor, Commissioners. The first photos that you saw were sent to me by Beaumont Wilshire, and they just wanted it included as their poster child for why they believe that something ought to be done to discourage demolitions. And then we're seeing some other images, showing the range of houses that are torn down and those that replace them.
Right. I'll continue to go through the slides if you want to.
Okay.
And again, a variety of zones, all single dwelling zones within the city. Again, house on the left-hand side that was demolished, replacement house on the right-hand side. Again, a smaller lot within the R7 zone, but structure being built to the zoning code standards.
So this shows the distribution of demolitions between 2010 and 2014. You'll see the concentration is really in the inner northeast and inner southeast, especially southeast neighborhoods. Fewer demolitions in southwest and in outer southeast.
And this is demolitions regardless of the condition of the house, right?
Correct. A demolition permit was pulled.
Right.
Yeah. Can you go to the next slide? So here's the data on demolitions. The blue column is showing demolitions of single-family homes in single-family zones. The green column is showing the demolition of single-family homes in other zones, so the multifamily zones, the mixed-use zones, CS, EX. And then finally, there are a few demolitions of single-family homes in industrial and even in an open space zone. So that's the pattern we've seen the last couple years. Next. This captures the change in average prices. So in 2013, the average recorded sales price of the house that was torn down was $221,000. And it was replaced by a house whose average sale price was $513,000. In 2014, that average sale price of the house torn down has risen to $267,000. But the sales price of the house that replaced it, the average is hovering around $500,000. Next slide. There's been question about demolitions and increasing density, and the proposal in front of you today proposes a rebate to address that. Here's a little of the history. In 2013, as best as we can tell, based on subsequent identifications of new lots and land divisions, a demolition in 47% of the cases in 2013 only resulted in one house being built, that one-for-one replacement that people talk about. In 2014, that was down a bit, so a house was torn down, and more frequently, more than one house was built. In 13% in 2013 and 11% in 2014, nothing has yet replaced it, so we don't know whether it'll be more than one unit. And then we're showing the number of lot confirmations where an additional lot was identified or a subsequent land division. So those created the opportunity for more density. And then just as a measure, as context, at the bottom it shows the total number of housing units permitted in those 2 years. So showing that these demolitions are really a very small subset of total housing production in the city. Thanks. Thomas is going to present the proposal and how the tax is structured. I just wanted to say we started by trying to keep it simple, to maintain current definitions both in the building code, in the property maintenance code, trying not to complicate the development process by encumbering the requirements for a demolition permit. For the most part, we've tried to keep that simple structure. We've added a few changes in response to particular concerns that we heard either from stakeholders or from the council. Thank you.
Thank you. So again, I'm Thomas Lanham with the Revenue Division. The proposed demolition tax is an excise tax in the amount of $25,000. It's a flat assessment. It's not without precedent. There are two jurisdictions just north of Chicago that have a similar tax. It's a $10,000 tax in those cases. They've been in place since about 2002, and they've withstood some legal challenges in those jurisdictions. The triggering event is the issuance of the demolition permit, not the application. So once the permit is issued, I'm assured by BDS that typically is followed through on at that point. The tax would be due 30 days after the assessment. There are two exemptions captured within the code right now. One is for catastrophic loss. We would look to definitions in IRS publications for that, but typically they're landslides, floods, fires, and one that we didn't call out specifically but probably should have in the ordinance is earthquakes. And then, of course, residential structures that are ordered, vacated, or demolished by the director of BDS working in conjunction with a code hearings officer under Title 29. There are also two rebates. Rebates are triggered by actions that occur subsequent to the assessment of the tax. One of them is for affordable housing. There's a directive within the code that would require the Bureau of Housing to set up some guidelines following the pattern that's already established in Chapter 30 regarding exemptions for system development charges. And also, the other rebate is for increased density, and BDS would develop some guidelines about what that looks like, but typically it's an increase in the number of dwelling units on a particular parcel. And then in terms of administration, this should be a very straightforward administration. We believe half an FTE would cover the work involved and some offsetting budget for that. It's captured in the findings. And I will stop there.
Thank you. Andy?
Right. Some definitions regarding demolitions and then looking at demolitions versus what was a new category of work called major remodels and then a little bit on the residential structures ordered, vacated, or demolished. And just to get started, we've been working on these definitions for about 2 years. We came back to council in December and then again in January and had those adopted. This is just an example of, you know, the code definition for demolition, which is removal of the superstructure down to the subflooring. Some of these examples identify how this is actually being put into practice, where what we see are, you know, if an applicant is working to remodel a home and a full wall line is retained and foundation continues to carry floor loads, those are considered alterations or remodels or additions, whereas if it's just a smaller chunk or a fragment of an existing wall that remains, or an exterior wall becomes an interior wall, those all fall into the definition of demolition. It's key to be able to make sure that people can still do the remodels, age in place, continue to invest in their homes, and improve their structures without it going into a demolition, the demolition delay, et cetera. We continue to streamline or work more closely with the neighborhood associations and to get notification out, which was really kind of the genesis of some of this definition, was to be able to provide early notification to neighbors, neighborhood associations, recognized organizations about demolitions occurring in their neighborhoods. Just to highlight the differences between the major alterations and additions versus the demolitions, major work includes adding any new story to an existing structure, increasing or replacing 50% or more of an exterior wall on any floor. Oftentimes you'll see that dormer addition or attic space be converted, and those can trigger the major alteration, which again is the impetus is to get the notification out to the neighbors so that they have an opportunity to have input if necessary or to be aware of when that construction activity is going to occur on an adjacent property. Again, adding a new, total new floor area to the existing structure that exceeds 800 square feet in size, or adding an area that exceeds 100% of the existing foundation footprint of the existing structure. These are all codified in Title 24 at this point. We've been utilizing these since April 20th of this year, so roughly 6 months. There have been about 100 major alteration addition permits thus far. We anticipate that will continue through the year, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 225 for the year as a whole since this code has been enacted. So I'll back up a couple pages here. With the residential structures ordered, vacated, or demolished, this is really a process that BDS initiates with the code hearings officer. It establishes a process that allows us to deal with structures that are that have structural or other life safety concerns, or they may be health hazards to the neighborhood or the occupants. And what we want to do is have a pathway to be able to address those quickly through the code hearings officer as a bureau-initiated response to those complaints that come in. With that, I'll turn it back to Jillian.
On the definition page,
yeah.
So just to be clear, the affordable housing rebate that you're proposing just tracks the SDC exemption program, same criteria?
Guidelines based on that program, yes. We would look to housing as having that expertise.
But it's the same formula that we use for SDC exemption for affordable housing?
Yes.
Yes. Why did you structure it as a rebate rather than a waiver?
Well, we can't know for certain up front whether or not that's the actual final use for the property. So we can't exempt them from the tax, but we can rebate them.
So the affordable housing provider would have to put up the $25,000 and get it back later?
That's correct. However, there is a possibility to request that they have a financial need of financial assistance or have a financial hardship, and in that case it could be waived.
And does this apply to accessory dwelling units?
You mean the demolition?
The demolition tax.
If you're demolishing an accessory dwelling unit, so if you have a house with an accessory dwelling unit on the lot and you demolish the ADU, is that going to be subject to this? Good question.
The ADU is an accessory structure. These typically are dealing with the primary structure on the site. So even a garage or a shed would be an accessory structure. We have not included that in our conversation as far as a demo of an ADU and a tax on it.
I want to be clear about that.
Yeah, good
another
point.
Question, Mayor.
Please.
Thomas, in the ordinance and the exhibit, it makes clear that the tax is strictly for revenue purposes?
That's correct.
Does that mean that the council has the usual discretion to determine what to do with the revenue?
That's correct. In this case, the ordinance directs that it...
I understand, but do we have the discretion to
yes,
direct
absolutely.
Where the money goes?
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, it directs it to go into the Housing Investment Fund.
Well, you're anticipating my amendment, so I wanted to make sure that we had it was at our discretion where the money is allocated.
Yes.
It is, and there's a separate discussion that I know that has occurred at the council level regarding redirecting other sources of revenue, for example, short-term rental revenue. Those are existing revenue streams that go to the general fund, and I think that's where the financial policy can get a little problematic. But in this case, this is a brand new tax, a brand new revenue stream, and it's a much cleaner proposition to direct it to a specific purpose.
So that's actually in the code, Commissioner, in 808.
That's the code section I'm going to offer an amendment.
Okay, cool.
So I'm interested to hear that it's primarily to raise money. Why then are we adding the exempting 64% of the properties on the latest numbers because they're building more than one unit?
Well, as in many cases, there are competing objectives that the city is trying to achieve. With this PITS affordability and resources for our affordable housing programs against accommodating increased growth that we know is coming, this tries to strike a balance.
But that's a policy choice for the council to take, whether we want this to apply to only 36% of demolitions or
correct.
If the primary purpose is to raise money for affordable housing, whether
correct.
We want it to apply elsewhere.
Correct.
No, that's a choice, and it's open to us to make either one. Other questions for the staff team at this point? Anything else that you wanted to cover that we haven't heard from you yet? We'll take testimony.
I have actually one more question, and it might be for the city attorney. We received a letter from the Home Builders Association, and Mr. Lanham, you referred to this as an excise tax. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chandler, who couldn't be here today, says that the state forbids us from having construction excise taxes. So what's our response to that?
It's a demolition excise tax.
He says that it's linked, though, to what's going to go on the property, particularly with the linking, whether it's one house or more than one house.
Right. So we've conferred with the city attorney's office, and it's not there. They don't share that opinion. And I guess I would defer to them at this point to answer that question.
We don't want to have that discussion.
Okay. He says he'll answer that question, but not here.
I have a hunch Mr. Chandler was going to give us a tort claim notice regardless of the
Okay.
Mayor, may I offer an amendment at this point?
Certainly.
While staff is
Certainly.
Present.
Yep.
So I appreciate some of the changes that were made in the version of the ordinance that's now before us. I want to focus on 6.08.080, which is the provision Commissioner Fritz identified earlier about the revenue being placed in the Housing Investment Fund. Currently, it is proposed that it go to the Housing Investment Fund for a specific purpose. And the proposal says for home repair and home ownership programs. I'm going to move to strike that specific purpose for the following reason. The Housing Investment Fund was, by definition, established to create a flexible spending, a source of revenue, to be used in a nimble and creative way by the Housing Bureau to address housing opportunities as they came along. It is antithetical to the idea of a flexible housing investment fund to start segregating funds and putting limitations on the use of those funds in the account, since it may very well be that the best use of those proceeds in the housing investment fund at any moment in time, maybe multifamily versus home ownership versus something else, because the purpose of the fund was to give the Bureau and the Commissioner in charge maximum flexibility with dollars that were not restricted as our TIF and federal funds, I think that the restriction, while I think I understand why that was proposed, I don't think fits the purpose of the HIF. So my amendment would be to strike at 6.08.080, the following, for home repair and home ownership programs.
Second.
Okay. Further discussion on accepting that amendment for purposes of public testimony? Okay. Roll call, please.
Novick.
Good idea. Aye.
Fritz.
Yes, I support this amendment. I also support this dedication because we do, in the Development Services Bureau, collect fees for other agencies for specific purposes. This is really different from taking a general fund piece of money and allocating it to a specific purpose, so I'm happy to support this amendment. Aye.
Fish?
I appreciate the support. And, Mayor, I think under this amendment, one could argue that these funds may actually be eligible to be counted against the $20 million of new money since they're no longer restricted to a specific activity. Aye.
Councilman?
Appreciate the amendment. Aye.
Hales.
Although I certainly think a good use of these funds is home repair and home ownership programs, I take your point about putting them into the HIF and then making that judgment call. Aye. Okay, that amendment's on the table. We want public testimony on that as well as on the rest of the matter.
Mayor, I have a correction to a statement that I made earlier. Commissioner Fritz, you asked about affordable housing and how the tax would apply to that. Actually, the financial hardship would only apply if they were appealing a penalty assessment. So at this point, the ordinance would require anyone putting up affordable housing to pay the tax up front and then request the rebate after the fact. Just want to get clear on that.
Of course, at this point, the tax applies to single-family construction on a single-family lot, not multifamily construction on a single on a multifamily lot.
Right.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Stand by. I'm sure we'll have more questions after we take testimony. And let's move the sign-up sheet, please.
There, I have a question. I have been trying to work out some amendment concepts and don't have anything ready for prime time. And I'm just curious. I mean, I can talk about what the concepts are today, but I'm just curious. Do you anticipate that we'll have a second first reading next week?
Oh, yeah.
We can offer additional amendments?
I'm anticipating we're going to get a lot of testimony about this. There's going to be more staff work that's going to be necessary to refine the proposal. So if you have other amendment ideas, there's nothing wrong at all with putting them out here, putting them out conceptually today, or you can wait till later, either one. Okay. With that, then let's take people that are signed up to speak.
We have a total of 28 people signed up. The first three, please come on up, are Robert McCullough, Janet Baker, and Barbara Strunk. And they'll be followed by Margaret Davis, John Sandy, and Terry Parker.
So, again, I know this is an important subject to a lot of you, but I'm going to ask you to confine your remarks to 2 minutes just so we can hear everybody.
Mayor, I slipped him in front of ENR, and they said they'd love to have their panel in one place. So
Do we need to call a fourth person? Is that the problem?
Either four or... just boot me out in a moment and let them have their panel.
All right, why don't we boot you out and let them have their panel since you're so...
Without objection, you'll be moved to the 7 p.m. Hearing.
I think I just gave up my first room, but I'm happy to do so because they're good folks.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so is there a third person that you wanted to have come up? Yeah, come on up, and then we'll call you next, Robert. Thank you.
Sounds good.
And you can bring another chair if there are four of you, so just grab a loose one. All right. All right. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hi. My name's Janet Baker, and I'm part of United Neighborhoods for Reform, and I live in Northeast Portland. So finally, the city proposes an alternative approach to curbing demolitions, a demolition tax. The tax is intended to play two roles. First, it's intended to disincentivize demolitions in tandem with the work of the Residential Infill Task Force, which will be completed in 2017. Secondly, it would provide some funding for low-income housing initiatives, a greatly underserved part of the Portland community. While we really appreciate the formation of the Residential Infill Task Force, which was part of our original UNR resolution, as you may recall, it'll be at least 18 months before the recommendations come before this group. We can't wait that long. Between now and then, hundreds more houses will be demolished in Portland and replaced with oversized suburban-style tract homes that only a very small fraction of Portland home buyers can afford. What's more, clearly the changes in the process for demolition delays are not working. Neighbors and city staff are grappling with the process to save well-built quality homes that have served generations of Portland families. Of the six successful appeals, ones that have made it through the hearing officer, not a single home has been saved. The only beneficiaries of the demolition boom have been the developers. They've made many millions of dollars on the backs of Portland homeowners and renters. Externality, a term used in economics, is the cost or benefit that affects a party who did not choose to incur that cost or benefit. The negative externalities of the demolition boom in Portland are way too many for me to number. In addition, the damage done to neighborhood fabric and the impacts on people living adjacent to these demolitions and construction projects, demolitions have destroyed many viable, affordable homes and apartments in Portland at a time when affordable housing is becoming increasingly hard to find. The money collected from this proposed demolition tax would go into a fund to address affordable housing issue. We believe it's only fair that the beneficiaries of the boom, the developers, should help pay for some of the negative externalities of their actions. Although UNR agrees that a demolition tax could help curb demolitions and raise money for affordable housing, we do not believe the proposed tax structure we're talking about today will achieve that goal. The next speakers will tell you why we don't believe the proposed tax will work, and what we submit as a revised tax for you to consider. Thank you for listening to us.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hello, my name is Barbara Strunk. I'm a member of United Neighborhoods for Reform, and I live in Northeast Portland. UNR does support the idea of a demolition tax to try to curb the number of demolitions of single-family homes. We do not support the current proposed tax as it stands right now, mainly with the rebates offered if two houses are built in place of one. The original form of the tax, with no rebates, has credibility, but we think it can be better. What we think will happen if this current tax is enacted is that the number of demolitions of viable single-family residences will increase, rebates will encourage demolitions and lot divisions. We will see greatly increased lot divisions and demolitions, especially in neighborhoods like Kenton, where nearly all the houses have underlying historical lot lines and are still somewhat affordable. We don't want to see any of these possibilities happen. What we want to see happen is an economic disincentive to most demolitions. We want to see an increase in the resources put toward housing affordability. We want to encourage the building of smaller, more affordable houses. And we want to avoid any policy that encourages more lot divisions. Our proposal is that the demolition fee should be $35,000. We think that the $25,000 is really just a drop in the bucket compared to the $800,000 to $1.3 million prices we're seeing on some of these new houses. People may claim that this tax will lower the price received by the seller of the old house, the one to be demolished. We argue that the seller needs to wait just a few more days, and they will get a bid from someone who wants to live in the house. And I'm running out of time.
Okay, and we see the rest of your yes. testimony here, Barb. Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. Welcome.
All right, thanks. I'm Margaret Davis with United Neighborhoods for Reform. I live in Northeast Portland. We are grateful that you brought this demolition tax forward. Demolitions hurt neighborhoods, and they hurt people. We respectfully submit a revised version that Carla handed out. It's already in code language. The simple structure of UNR's revised tax, $35,000 flat tax on both demolitions and major remodels, will achieve the aim of protecting affordable housing and amassing funding for more. Minus exemptions, rebates, and loopholes, the revised tax is also far easier to administer. Thank you, Mayor Hales, for coming to our Neighborhood Association meeting on Monday and asking for feedback on this tax. At that time, you cited marginal success for the previous efforts by this council to combat demolitions. I would argue that submarginal or zero success better describes those efforts. To illustrate, under the demo delay rules, as Janet said, no house has been saved. Same with deconstruction. That voluntary program, which involves giving money to developers to do the right thing by foregoing wasteful and hazardous mechanical demolition, has had no takers since it was instituted. And in fact, staff encouraged an application just this week from somebody, but that house is already gone. Such non-results highlight the need for real ones. One constant in these underwhelming measures so far was heavy influence by members of the Development Review Advisory Committee, or DRAC. DRAC, which includes many developers, does an excellent job of finessing permitting processes. This demo tax is not one. We have been assured by the mayor on Monday that any changes, revisions made to this tax will go through the revenue department, and we hope through transparent process. We're counting on it. Demolitions take it all away. The affordable housing, mature urban trees, character and history, and uncontaminated dirt and air, among other irreplaceable assets of our community. This is your third try at curbing demolitions. Please make it matter. Commissioner Fritz, you led the charge against smoking in the parks. You should be against demolitions. They spread lead and asbestos, which cause health effects similar to smoking, maybe even worse. Commissioner Saltzman, you care about children through your children's levy. The Centers for Disease Control says there's no amount of lead that's safe in children, and bulldozed homes exude lead. Commissioner Novick, you care about waste and resource waste and climate change. There's no way you can recoup the carbon cost of throwing an old growth home in the dumpster. And Commissioner Fish, if you care about affordable housing and aging in place, these are homes that serve generations of Portlanders and could have served many more. So thank you again for bringing this demolition tax forward. And we hope, Council, that you will consider a revised tax that will actually work. Thank you.
Margaret, I have just two quick questions. You mentioned the DRAC earlier.
Yes.
And my understanding is that the DRAC has not officially weighed in on this. Is that correct?
I don't know. I'll see at the meeting tomorrow. I know they've talked about it.
Well, my understanding is that they have not taken a position.
To my knowledge, no. I read the minutes of the last meeting.
They did send us a letter saying they were disappointed that they were excluded from the review and vetting process.
And we do have somebody here to testify on that.
Yeah. So that would be consistent with my point that they have not taken a position. I understand they would like to have a role, but since you mentioned DRAC, I just want to make sure I hadn't missed something because I was not aware they had taken an official position.
Well, again, we're just looking at future any revisions made to this tax or the changing that might go on. We hope will go through the Revenue Division or some other body, but we feel like DRAC is not the place to do it.
Although I will say, just speaking as one commissioner, I would welcome DRAC's comments as I would any citizen body because they have a point of view, and I would hope there's a formal way to get their perspective. This is not directly related to your testimony, but since you mentioned hazardous materials, since we last had a hearing on this subject, there was a series in the Oregonian about, let's put it politely, lax oversight of some state rules on asbestos and asbestos abatement. Are you addressing that separate and apart from demolitions in terms of where you think the city should land?
Well, I feel like the city could do a lot to control hazmat. All we have to do is drive across the river to Vancouver and see how they do it.
So,
but if you curb demolitions, you've already taken care of your hazmat problem.
That's one way to do it. I guess the other way would be to figure out where and how we could regulate that area in light of the fact that the state is now regulating. So
yes.
All I'm saying is I would welcome any thoughts you would have on that subject independent of demolitions.
Well, and we're anxious to see how the city will comply with the recent state law passed about asbestos surveys. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Okay. I think Mr. McAuliffe and a couple other people are next.
Robert McAuliffe, John Sandy, and Terry Parker. And they will be followed by Mary Helen Kincaid, Brandon Spencer Hartle, and Paul Grove.
Mr. Mayor, may I apply for two more minutes under your long-time policy?
Nice try. But you mean because you're Southeast Uplift Chair?
Yes.
I guess, sir. For that reason. I thought you because you've taken a bump. But, yes, because you're Southeast Uplift Chair.
Actually, you and I are allies of ours, so that would be a little pushing it.
Since you're a district coalition chair, yes.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank the council and the mayor for the help in the Martins problem. Thank you very much for the mediation by your staff. I would like to note that it was kind of you to send me an email on the morning of the confrontation asking whether I was arrested, but I do need to counsel you. The police take away your smartphone when they put you in jail. So next time, send me a telegram, okay?
That would constitute cruel and unusual punishment, I think.
I'm representing Southeast Uplift. We received news of these changes through Brad Schmidt. We like Brad Schmidt a lot, but it underscores the process of public involvement. Brad, I hope you say something nice about me today.
Robert, please don't encourage him.
So to a degree, I'm without portfolio. The executive committee meeting is this afternoon at 5. Our next land use committee meeting is on Monday. We do have a Thursday neighborhood association meeting. We'd love to have you attend. It's in your own elementary school, and we'd love to have you. The bottom line is we've been working on this proposal, reviewing it, following it. I've talked to you about it before. The sudden shift surprised us. We did some polling on it. The polling had two very different answers. The answers from the well-established neighborhoods closer to the river was the 25,000 was too low to be effective. From the neighborhoods closer to I-5, Brentwood, Darlington, the answer was actually rather strong, and that was, this will defeat our attempt to renew houses that need renewal. And so in both directions, there were some doubts about the proposal. and I noticed UNR had some proposals here, and they sounded good, and we may well endorse them when we get a chance. But the bottom line is the change loses both. We go from something that might, in fact, slow the pace of demolitions to something that will enhance it. On the margins confrontation, the problem was that we had a subdivision that was pretending to be a single-family demolition, hence to get, I think, the last of the K1 exemptions. Simultaneously, of course, they proposed clear-cutting 20 trees, including, as we know, three majestic redwood-style sequoias. However, the point of the matter is, cutting 20 trees was based on building two houses. So at BDS, they were simultaneously accepting a contradiction simply to get the answer the developer wanted. They were building two houses for cutting trees and one house for getting the exemption. Under your new rule, we suspect we'll see the exact opposite. People will pretend to build two houses and only mean to build one. The fact of the matter is we're applying duct tape to duct tape. We have to apply truth in zoning. We have to get the zoning rules back in shape. I noticed your own staff were unable to follow through the R5. The one staffer said 5,000 square feet. As we all know, it's been years since R5 meant 5,000 square feet. Another staffer confused demolitions with remodels until Amanda Fritz changed that rule. Thank you. We had demolitions that were, in fact, pretending to be remodels. I can remember standing next to one, next to a school here in Portland, with asbestos, no controls, and a bulldozer remodeled the house. Now, generally, we believe bulldozers are not a tool of remodeling. And so as we end up with these very complex and exaggerated solutions, what we need is a lot more discussion. We have been headed on this. We will be coming back with more detailed statements. But at the moment, we're a little upset for being left out. We checked with DRAC, Mary Helen Kincaid, who, as you know, is a friend of mine. She had not been consulted. Citywide Land Use Committee had not been consulted. Our land use representatives on the infill committee had not been consulted. In fact, you got some pretty angry letters from our land use guys who are fierce. So please don't lose the resources. We're not just an interest group. We're working our tails off on this stuff. And let me close, by the way, with something that's tongue-in-cheek. As you know, as an economist, I have no sense of humor. It was surgically removed when I was an executive at the power company. Very painful. If we're really talking about affordable housing, one of my staff proposed yesterday to me that it was very simple. 2/3 of all of the Airbnbs are now not licensed, and therefore we have an enormous housing stock pretty much taken out of the normal use. And that'd be an excellent place for a voucher system for the homeless this winter.
May I ask a question? You mentioned polling. Is that a scientific poll that you
No. We are masters of non-scientific polling, and I apologize for it. The only defense I can make of our polling is that it's honest, though innocent.
So it was a survey of the Southeast Uplift Coalitions.
It is a survey going through Nextdoor, and it's simply the sort of issue where you can use that software to ask the question. In this case, it was pretty much a question of whether the original proposal would work well or not. And then there was an enormous dialogue through Nextdoor on this.
Well, I applaud you for doing that and for having the conversation with neighborhoods like Brentwood-Darlington. I've heard from neighborhoods further east and indeed some in Southwest that there was a similar concern that the proposal would result in housing that needs to go not being demolished.
Absolutely. And Southeast Uplift, as you know, goes from one level to the other level of extreme on income, et cetera.
Please. Yeah.
Robert, two questions. First, a comment. If only 2/3 of the short-term rentals were not permitted, that would be progress, because I think we're closer to 90%.
Well, that's an interesting question. I'll be impressed if that's true, because that's not the statistics we've seen. But please have the staffer who has that tell us, because it's very different than what we've seen.
But the second thing, I think the situation
but
is worse.
But it's okay to put a homeless in a permitted Airbnb.
I think the level of compliance is worse, and I think the easy way to resolve that is for simply the platform owner to refuse to advertise any unit that can't verify that they've obtained a necessary permit, which I think is not only a responsible thing, it ensures that the guest has got a safe night's sleep. But let me
absolutely, I agree with that.
Let me come back to the let me tap your you wearing your hat as an economist. Some say that a demolition fee is going to drive up the cost of housing. Others say that what's really affecting the current market is that people want to live in Portland, and they're paying a premium. Where do you land on that?
Well, any good Econ 102 class will tell you it's a bit of both. And the elasticity of demand, if it's high, would mean that the buyer would pay more of the tax. In this case, most of the concerns we had from East Moreland residents was 25,000 would not have postponed Everett Custom Homes from the demolition levels they're undertaking. When we're talking about million-dollar homes resulting, this almost certainly is not going to deter them. You've heard our outrage on the $1,200 per 150-foot giant sequoias. Often I notice in public policy, staff have very limited ideas of the real financial impact. The dollars in these developments are enormous, and the dollars needed to actually have an impact on developers are going to be enormous.
Well, what about our friends in outer southeast, who, as you noted, might have a different view on this, and who are looking at a demolition fee as an obstacle to replacing a house that may have reached its useful life with another home, which also might end up being affordable?
I agree entirely, and that's one of the reasons why we were a little surprised that things had shifted so suddenly. For myself, if we were going to have a tax, it would have to be graduated, I think graduate's the right word, in some degree to apply to both areas. One size does not fit all on a tax.
If it's graduated, is the simplest way, if we were to take that approach, just to have a floor, exempt the $150,000 homes altogether, for example?
I think that would be one, but I've got to tell you, if we just look at the Martin situation, the home was bought for a bargain, and the two homes were almost certainly going to be in the million-dollar range. $25,000 was not going to affect that at all, and so we would almost have to have some sort of percentage that would get the dollar amount up to where it would have an impact.
So, Robert, appreciate you and UNR and others being willing to now try to take this to a point where we believe it, again, does what I think we all agree it should do. So, and you know that some of the thinking that's gone into this and developing it so far, we originally were looking at the tax assessment bifurcation in which each house is assigned a land value and an improvements value. As it turns out, through whatever quirks of the Multnomah County assessment and taxation system, those numbers have very little to do with the actual land value and improvements value of a typical house. So we are looking for ideas for how to graduate the tax. The $25,000 flat amount is the simplest and easiest to administer version of this idea. But we're looking for you and others who are economists or not to try to devise a way to graduate it. We're interested, and we're getting testimony. I've heard a lot from neighborhoods already about whether the two-for-one replacement situations should be included or not included, and most recently whether, if we proceed with the version that's now in front of the council where it only applies to one-for-one, that it'll create a perverse incentive to do more two-for-one, which we already heard here this evening or this afternoon. Dollar amount, we're interested in that. And then we're also interested in what constitutes a derelict house. It's a little bit like Potter Stewart's definition of pornography. We all know one when we see one. I've been out in the field with some of the builders who are here to speak and seen some of the houses they propose to demolish, and I told them at the time, I think most neighborhoods would send them a bouquet instead of a tax bill if they would demolish that house. The question is, how do we in code define that house? We've made an attempt at that with this language about the code hearings officer's findings. It may not be the right way to do it. So those areas, what should the dollar amount be, how do we graduate it, and how do we define a derelict house other than it's obvious are areas where we need help in the development of this ordinance.
Thank you, Mayor, and the Land Use Committee of Southeast Uplift is happy to work on it. They are much smarter than I am. I was sent here to express outrage, despair, unhappiness. I've done a poor job since you've heard all that before. I've tried reason instead. But we'd like to come back next week with those detailed issues. And frankly, those guys, Michael Molinari and Rod Merrick and all of their colleagues, are working their tails off. So don't leave them out of the mix. They are doing their best to help.
We appreciate their service on the task force.
So you mentioned next week. It sounds
this isn't going to happen next week.
Right. So I'm glad to hear that. It feels more like a planning commission hearing to me than a final.
It's an initial public hearing. We don't have a schedule for when this is going to happen.
Well, you know, I only hear about this from Brad Schmidt, so what do I know?
He does a fine job, but don't believe everything you read in the papers. Sir, welcome.
Mayor and commissioners, my name is John Sandy, and I'm a frustrated neighbor from Northeast Portland. And I think I am representing most probably thousands of others sharing a similar state of mind. I'm going to vary from the text a bit. That could be a problem, but we'll do it to try to address some issues that have come up. One is timeliness. I've heard a lot of people say we weren't involved in the decision. But for almost 2 years, despite countless meetings and thousands of hours of city resources and civic-minded volunteers, we have achieved no impact, appreciable result of slowing the demolition of housing down. So timeliness has to be factored into this. I appreciate the mayor and the council looking at an issue to try to address this issue, but I have to impress timeliness. Right now, we have to do something, that's my plea, do something to slow down the demolitions to allow the residential infill project time to do its job and what it was chartered to do, let alone, as Nick Fish brought up with the recent Oregonian, allow DEQ and the contractors to get their act together when you're talking about hazardous materials. We can't just sit by and accept the status quo on that for longer than the 2 years that we've been sitting on the sidelines right now. We need to do something to address that right now. So that's my plea to you. Get something done. If you've got to get input from all the resources, as Robert has indicated, fine. Do it in a timely, effective manner. And please, for my benefit, prove that an acting municipal body can actually get through the details and actually do some concrete work. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Parker.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Terry Parker from Northeast Portland. I'm a fourth-generation Portlander. Voters are upset, even angry, over the large number of home demolitions that are taking place in their neighborhoods. For a tax to be effective as it applies to the primary purpose of managing home demolitions, it must be simple, straightforward, and all-inclusive, not a watered-down sprinkler system full of loopholes that are large enough to run a steam locomotive through. Rebates that encourage lot splitting will diminish neighborhood green space and neighborhood fabric. Affordable homes are the ones that are being torn down. I fully support the testimony that has been presented by the UNR speakers. I'll keep it short. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Next three are Mary Helen Kincaid, Brandon Spencer Hartle, and Paul Grove. And they will be followed by Jerry Johnson, Dan Franks, and Eric Thompson.
I want to thank whoever signed me up first because I want to be home for the Royals game at 5 o'clock. So
it's like you're gonna make
I might not be here for the end of this. I'm not a Houston's fan, no.
Approached by a lot of people in the marijuana industry to find out how you got to the front head of the line.
I'm not telling.
If you're here this morning, that actually is relevant.
I'm not going to disclose that.
Thank you.
For the record, Mary Helen Kincaid. I'm the chair of the Development Review Advisory Committee, otherwise known as DRAC. You all received a letter from DRAC, and I think are aware of that, so I don't need to publicly read that or take up my 2 minutes. My point is, and as usual, I started out with something, and then as I started hearing things, I changed a little bit. But I think the nexus of all of this is we need to figure out what the future desired outcome is, and everybody speaks to demolitions. The DRAC demo ordinance subcommittee was not formed to stop demolitions, but it was to create a conditions under which neighbors could be notified. The K1 exception went out the window, and the 35-day delay offered opportunity for notification and for neighborhoods to provide evidence of why they should save that property. You've heard testimony, and I have to agree with them. It hasn't saved a single house. There were 6 appeals. 3 were approved, 3 were denied, 1 before it even started. I've come to the conclusion that we need to start at the very beginning. There needs to be some opportunity, and this is why I think there should have been more discussion, that DRAC should have been brought into this, because this was part of our discussion, but it was not the purveyance of what we were supposed to do. But we need to start at the beginning. Robert McCullough mentioned Mike Molinaro, who's on the Southeast Uplift and the RIP. Oh, I'm really running. He's developed a program. Commissioner Saltzman's staff has seen it. Paul Scarlett's seen it. It identifies houses that are significant. The neighborhoods could identify those. That way we could deal with them. We've had preliminary discussions with PCRI, Habitat for Humanity, Proud Ground, that they could take the ownership part of it, transfer that, but it's not finished yet. I'd like to see that pursued. I'd like to see, and I proposed this to Commissioner Saltzman the other day, I'd like to see a committee that can get some good substantive things and can do something to affect the demolition process. I don't think we need to go with economic disincentives. I think we need to go with economic incentives, those people that are going to do something good. I don't know exactly how it all works, because this all caught me by surprise as a DRAC member and as a citizen and as a land use person in my neighborhood that this proposal was out there. It was discussed at one DRAC subcommittee meeting for about all of 5 minutes, and there was really no resolution or recommendation from that meeting. Mayor Hales, you said about we want to preserve good old houses that are good for the neighborhood. I don't think anybody disputes that. But what's a good way to do that? It's not after the permit's been issued and a developer spent $40,000 on plans, and then the neighborhoods get set up for an argument and an appeals process. I just don't think that's a fruitful way to go at it. It doesn't address ADUs. You've heard, and I was thought we should take a poll here because we could probably end this hearing now. How many people think this is a good idea as it stands? You've got developers, you've got UNR, you've got your DRAC subcommittee all say, we need to hit the reset button and do something really productive here. So I think it's going to require interbureau work. I think we proved DRAC can work with a variety of stakeholders to come out with a good resolution. So I'd like to see incentives for smaller houses. There's all kinds of things that could be built into this. I don't see it as I think the revenue production will be the revenue savings that people will have because there's, and I like to use the term, Maxine Fitzpatrick taught me this term, affordability as opposed to affordable housing. So we need to make affordability part of our language. My only other question, and this can be for staff later if I'm still here, who the stakeholders were that you met with? I just heard that you met with Beaumont Wilshire on Monday night. Why not DRAC the last previous 2 months? And it says that in the, I wanted to bring council's attention to the impact statement where it says that mayor's office shared a concept with stakeholders in August 2015 and shared a draft proposal with stakeholders in September 2015. I'd argue that DRAC is a huge stakeholders group and we never got any of that information. So I'm concerned about the content in these from my public involvement advisory committee experience. Public involvement didn't really happen there. So,
Mary Helen,
I'm going to end.
Maybe I needed to do a more complete version of setting the table for this at the beginning, so let me try again. I mentioned this topic and said that we would be working on this in January of this year when I gave my State of the City speech. I realize not everyone listens to my State of the City speech, but I brought it up. In April of this year, I was at a UNR forum on Sandy Boulevard, and I brought it up there, and then my staff has been working on it for 6 months. It's a revenue proposal, not a development review proposal. Your DRAC committee is welcome to look at this revenue proposal and comment on it. And then finally, I've been trying to say this all along. I'll say it again. I brought this to this hearing today as a proposal. It's an idea. It's a good deed that should be punished, or maybe it isn't.